Hello, and welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we discuss The Teen Titans, The Judas Contract, published by DC Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions: how good is this story really? And does it belong in that body of great comic book works known as the Comics Canon? My name is Kevin Morrow, Boy Wonder.
And my name's Kurt Holman. And you know, Boy Wonder, they've got the bad guys on the run. They'll never stop till the job gets done. Because when the world is losing all control, Teen Titans go. 1, 2, 3, 4, go, Teen Titans.
You know, I wasn't sure where you were going for a minute there. I was like, is this like a mid-80s Judas Priest song?
It's more like, it's the theme song, as you probably gathered, of the Cartoon Network's 2000s Teen Titans show. And it's funny because I read all the Marv Wolfman, George Perez Teen Titans comics in the 80s, you know, like just after they came out and kind of when they were coming out. You know, I jumped in a little after I think Judas Contract had come out. And then kind of like not really thought about them that much, like in the 90s and afterwards. And then I had a daughter, and the Cartoon Network show came on, and we watched that, and I'm a pretty big fan of it. So the show is kind of more my touchstone of the characters than the comic books. And in the show, the characters are a bit more broad and comedic and kind of exaggerated in ways that don't always fit the comics, you know. So I'm going to refer to some of the show stuff in this discussion, you know, and they actually do the second season of the Teen Titans does the Judas Contract, or its own version of it, you know. So it's kind of a way that the comics had a ripple through the culture.
And while we're talking about animation, part of the reason that we picked this story to do now is because of the animated movie version of it that is coming out as we speak.
Yeah, it's due on a digital download on April 4th and home media on April 18th. Yeah.
So we figured, you know, what better time than now. Yeah. Can't do it any sooner than right now.
Yeah.
So Kurt, that's your history with the Teen Titans, and I figured I'd just get mine out of the way up front. I remember picking up probably the second part of the Brother Blood storyline from the original run, like in the I think in the early 20s or something, back in the early 80s. I hadn't really read any Teen Titans, and picked it up at like a drugstore, and it was everything that I wanted out of like a Silver Age comic, even though it's not the Silver Age, obviously, you know, just really colorful and mostly recognizable characters, and, you know, kind of a over-the-top bad guy. And then the next issue, you know, there's outer space involved, and like for that brief moment, you know, those brief collection of issues, I really loved it. And so I had friends who had back issues, and, you know, like read up from the beginning up to where I was then, and then, you know, was reading as it went forward, and kind of sadly for me, right when I jumped on, it started to kind of go off the rails for me a little bit, like the big outer space arc where you meet Starfire's family and everything is a bit, was a bit of a letdown for me. And I say all that to say that this story, like, really, you know, I was about to quit getting the book when the Judas Contract happened, and it bought me a little more. it bought the series a little more currency with me.
Yeah.
Can you buy currency?
I guess you have to exchange currency, you know.
Yeah. But so I've always looked at this as kind of the high point of the series, which is generally favorably looked upon, but it's very much a product of its time, as I think we're going to get into as we discuss this.
Yeah, I would say that of like the Teen Titans like story arcs, like the Judas Contract is probably the best regarded. And there's kind of the Trigon arc where Raven's father, who's kind of the devil, basically has kind of invaded the earth and is bringing about an apocalypse, you know. Yeah. So, and they actually do that in the fourth season of the Teen Titans show, but in a kind of slightly less intense way than the comics do. But anyway.
So why don't we just go ahead and get started? We'll do the creators and the summaries. These issues.
We should shout out the Teen Titans team on this, because some of them aren't very important on this arc, so we might not mention them as much, you know. But it's like it started out as a team of sidekicks, you know, basically, and they started adding characters who are sort of either not as well known as sidekicks or just, I think, just sort of original to the team, you know.
Yeah.
So this starts with Robin, you know, Batman sidekick, Wonder Girl, Kid Flash, as kind of like original ones, and Kid Flash leaves, you know, during the first issue we're going to talk about, and Cyborg, Raven, Starfire, and former Beast Boy, now changeling, Garfield Logan, you know, they sort of round out the team, and they have kind of their newest, youngest member, who we'll get to soon.
Yeah. All right, so the creators are... Writer for these issues is Marv Wolfman, artist George Perez, inkers Romeo Tanghal, Dick Giordano, Mike DiCarlo, and the aforementioned George Perez, colors Adrian Roy and Anthony Tallon, letterers Ben Oda, Bob Lappin, John Costanza, and Todd Klein, and edited by Marv Wolfman and George Perez. We should point out that we used the trade paperback as our source material for this, of the Judas Contract, which is a bit out of print, but it collects issues 39 through 44 and annual number 3. For our purposes, we're skipping issues 40 and 41 because they don't have a lot to do with the actual story.
There's this brother blood story in his native country, which fine, you know.
Yeah.
But the 39 kind of sets up the story that we're going to get, and the other issues kind of dig into it.
42 through 44 and then annual number 3 are actually the four-part Judas Contract story.
Yeah. So issue 39 is called Crossroads. The Teen Titans bust up a secret Alaskan base of cult leader Brother Blood with help of their newest and youngest member, Tara. Plot twist, Tara is a sociopathic double agent learning the Titan secrets at the behest of Slade Wilson, a.k.a. Deathstroke the Terminator. Slade tests Tara's earth-moving powers, which almost kill him. At a Titans meeting, Kid Flash announces that he's going back to college, and Dick Grayson gives up his Robin secret identity.
Issue 42, The Eyes of Tara Markov. Tara spends the day with the Titans in their civilian guises, seeing their homes and listening in on Donna and Terry Long's wedding plans. Tara and Garfield kiss at sunset. During a training fight, Garfield taunts Tara, who loses her temper and almost kills him. Slade reveals to Tara his plan to fulfill his late son Grant's contract to deliver the Titans to the mysterious cabal known as Hive. An unknown woman has Slade under surveillance.
Issue 43, Betrayal. Slade ambushes Dick Grayson at his apartment, but Dick successfully escapes. Dick goes to the homes of the other Titans and deduces how Slade had already defeated and captured Starfire, Wonder Girl, Cyborg, and Changeling. He finds Titan's Tower deserted, but soon meets Adeline and her son Joseph. Adeline explains that Tara is a traitor who captured Raven and adds that she's Slade's ex-wife. Slade notifies the Hive that the contract is complete.
Issue 44, There Shall Come a Titan. Adeline recounts her backstory with Slade, beginning with their meeting as elite soldiers in the early 1960s. They fell in love, married, and had two sons, but were estranged when Slade became an international assassin with enhanced strength and reflexes. Joseph lost his ability to speak in a hostage situation, and Slade lost an eye when Adeline tried to shoot him. Dick decides to trust them and rescue his teammates under a new alter ego, Nightwing. Joseph reveals a mutant ability to possess others and the codename Jericho.
Annual 3, Finale. At their base, Hive holds the heroes helpless in an innervator. Tara gloats that she was a traitor all along. Nighthawk and Jericho infiltrate the Hive base. At Slade's estate, Adeline holds a gun on Slade's butler, Wintergreen, who talks about their history. Nighthawk and Jericho are captured, but Jericho uses his powers to possess Slade and free the Titans. Believing she's been betrayed, Tara attacks Slade and the Titans, but loses control of her powers and fatally buries herself in an avalanche. At the end, the Titans keep her betrayal secret and give her a hero's funeral.
So, to varying degrees, I guess depending on how the conversation goes, we're going to mention the X-Men a little bit.
Yeah.
But I wanted to come right out of the gate and say that both of these stories came out, well, both of these titles, the new Teen Titans and the Uncanny X-Men, were popular around the same time in the early 80s. Mm. Obviously, the X-Men as we know them today, Giant Size X-Men came out in 1975, and had been around a little while longer, whereas Teen Titans came out in the 80s and was always accused of sort of being an attempt to cash in on, you know, the X-Men's popularity. And so
now, did you see the quote from Marv Wolfman where I think it's in the book. I was looking it up on.
Yeah, that's what I was. That's what I was getting to. Yeah. Is that he? You know, this storyline grew out of. I thought he had to sort of tweak those readers. You know, those readers who accused the Teen Titans of sort of being a ripoff of the X-Men. Yeah. Like, well, I'm going to introduce our own like Kitty Pryde type character, this sweet, adorable little teenage girl, and have her be totally evil.
Yeah. So, and it's funny, we talked about last year, the Dark Phoenix saga of the X-Men. So if you want to listen to our Dark Phoenix episode, we touch on some of this stuff. And Kitty Pryde was very new to the X-Men at that time. And that story also has a female member of the team going evil, basically. And so the titles handle that concept a little differently. So we'll sort of get into some of those differences a little bit later. But it's interesting how these books, you know, X-Men and the Titans had this sort of competition, you know, at the time. And as creative teams, Chris Claremont and John Byrne and Marv Wolfman and George Perez seemed very congruent almost. That they, you know, the writers have similar, you know, kind of approaches and the artists have similar approaches.
Perez and Byrne definitely did, yeah. Maybe not so much Dave Cockrum, who was also an artist on X-Men for a while. The thing about the Teen Titans, though, is it's both their blessing and their curse that they seem to have a deeper legacy because, as you mentioned, they were originally, the whole concept was just basically sidekicks of, you know, the adult superheroes. You have Robin, you have Wonder Girl, Kid Flash, and Aqualad, I believe, were like the original four. And then later, like Speedy, Green Arrow's sidekick, becomes a member. And they brought in some others who weren't necessarily teen sidekicks, but that had been kind of the shadow that they hung under. Whereas the new Teen Titans in the 80s is very different. It's very much about these young adults trying to find their own place in a way, especially Dick Grayson slash Robin slash Nightwing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how it's kind of comparing the titles. The Teen Titans feels a little bit more grounded and in kind of the civilian lives of the main characters compared to the way the X-Men books did at the time. And it's like, comics, so it's not super real, but in here we see, like, you know, Wonder Girl has her job as a freelance photographer, and she's, you know, engaged to this guy, and they're talking about their wedding plans and how to do it. So it feels like it has kind of this sort of quotidian reality, you know, whereas the X-Men feels a little bit more rarefied and kind of the battles and crazy things that they get up to, you know.
Well, yeah, and they all live together in a school, which can take away the relatability element of, you know, following people in their civilian guises, as it were.
But let's get into the book specifically, because I have some things I want to also kind of say kind of up front. I have some, like, issues with the Usual's Contract as a story, some of which are kind of small and one of which is really big, which is going to come later. But one of the ones that is, like, it's kind of big, but not the one I'm getting to, is I'm going to call him Beast Boy, because that's kind of how I know him from the show, you know, and I think it's a better name than any of his other names, is his relentless and insufferable sexual harassment.
Yes.
I mean, most characters, there are a lot of characters in books at this time, they'll be kind of a flirty one who, you know, says things to the ladies and all that, and Beast Boy is kind of that one for this, and seems particularly obnoxious and, you know, incessant about it. Added to the fact that, you know, he'll turn into his animal guise and touch people. Like, he'll, like, jump into someone's arms as a monkey and hug them, or wrap around them like a snake.
Or an octopus or something.
Yeah, or an octopus, you know.
And there's one scene where he's a dog, like, running around the heels of the other characters and basically upskirting. I think it's Raven or Wonder Girl, one of them.
He's apparently like he lives with this rich family, and there's a part where, like, a servant is saying, it's like, I wouldn't call being squeezed by a boa constrictor harmless. And it's like, indeed not, you know. I mean, he should be in, like, courtrooms, you know. It's like, It's just too much, you know. And so
there's a scene
aged very badly.
Yeah, you know? There's the scene where he and Tara are being tutored by a tutor that his super billionaire stepfather Steve Dayton has hired, and it's like the umpteenth one, and she quits because he keeps coming on to her and making the wisecracks, and yeah, it ages really poorly.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, ha, 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 he's a sex criminal, you know. It's like, okay, now, come on. It made me the same thing, like, you just, you know, for me, like, the touching in animal form crosses a lot of lines, you know.
To a point, I see where it kind of, you know, it's true to, like, a hormonal teenage character.
Yeah.
But it goes so far. I'm going to surprise you, Kurt. I mean, this is going to come as a shock to you, but when I was a teenager, I didn't necessarily have a lot of game.
Yeah.
So I would make, you know, these kind of really obvious come-ons like he does. Mm-hmm. I think to my credit, I knew when it wasn't working and when to stop before it crossed a line. And this is really painful reading some of these exchanges. Mm. And he's always talking about, you know, we should have sex right now with like Starfire or Wonder Girl. Yeah. Like, yeah, she comes out in a costume, I think, when she's modeling.
Yeah.
Starfire does. And he's like, no, don't listen to him. That outfit looks horrible. Take it off right away. Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, my God.
Do we have to bring HR in here again, Garfield? You know. But what you say about him being a teenager, it's like there's a point there. And I was thinking about there's the part where he and Tara kiss, and then they're like kind of fighting the next day and that kind of the training thing. And he's like, you know, well, give me a kiss and, you know, I'll let you go or whatever. And she gets like, really mad, but it's also like, you can see a teenager like, okay, we've like achieved what seems like this other level of a relationship. So he's like, the goalposts have changed and he kind of corrects in the wrong way, in a way.
That's a really good point.
I feel like that's a kind of a justifiable thing, you know, even though he's a huge jerk, you know, and deserves kind of getting his clock cleaned, you know.
And even the way...
Not that I advocate violence, but, you know...
Even the way that Slade Wilson, a.k.a. Deathstroke the Terminator, I feel we should say the full name as often as we can.
As I was going to say, it's like, you know, it's comics, like, but... You can be called Deathstroke. You can be called the Terminator. Being called Deathstroke the Terminator is a little much, you know.
But even the way that Deathstroke takes him out with the poison glue on the envelopes when he is signing, you know, a stack of photographs to send out to his adoring fan club, which, like, you know, one, it plays to his teenage vanity, but also, like, if these girls knew what he was really like, they wouldn't be writing him.
It seems like the kind of thing that could happen to Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, also. Yeah. You know? And I don't want this to be kind of the picking at the little critiques too much, you know, even though there's going to be a fair amount of that, because as the story goes, I feel like this moves well, and I like George Perez's art very much, and I have a lot of affection for this story on the narrative storytelling level. And it's there's some like problematic sexism kind of things going on in this, but it also deserves credit for having a lot of female characters who are different, you know, have different personalities, you know, and I think it would like pass the Bechdel test, you know, if you wanted to apply that.
And
Wonder Girl becomes the team leader, you know, during this.
She and Starfire are both very empowered characters. Raven, to an extent, yes, and Raven passes the Bechdel test. She's not moaning about, you know, a guy or anything, but, you know, she's kind of a bit one note in her, I must be alone and with my struggle and, you know, just kind of, you know, being the square peg around the, you know, the rest of the round pegs. But, you know, she's also very powerful in her own right and, you know, helps the team out on occasion. And, but then there's Tara, who is, let's get into this. You know, she's very powerful. Also mentally ill. I think it's pretty obvious. And also in an extremely inappropriate sexual relationship with Deathstroke the Terminator.
Yeah. That's, it's something that like, you know, is revealed pretty soon, you know,
in issue 39, you know, where not only do we learn that she is against the team, you know, that she's a plant, by the Terminator, by Deathstroke the Terminator. Yeah. But she's wearing like this nightgown, yeah. smoking a cigarette, you know, a signifier of evil.
Oh, it's absolutely, yeah. It's almost comical how the it's like she's bad and, you know, it's like, she's evil and she's smoking.
And you know? Her legs are crossed, yeah. you know, and kind of bare. And yeah. she's like a kind of a cartoon Mae West caricature there in a way. And it's later revealed that like she just turned 16.
Yeah. You wonder if Deathstroke is like his estate is on one of those states where that's the age of consent, you know, just so he can tell himself that there's nothing wrong, you know, with it. Yeah. And one thing, you know, they never kind of mentioned this, but Adeline Deathstroke's ex-wife probably isn't too impressed that he's in this relationship, you know. We're at a little bit of a disadvantage because we haven't freshly read the stories where they introduced Terra and brought her into the team. So there's, it's not a shock to us. Well, it wouldn't be a shock because we read it already, but we don't get the setup where it's like, oh, she seems troubled, but okay, in a good addition. And now we find out that she's super evil, you know,
right.
and uncouth, which is almost as bad as being evil in this, you know. I kind of wondered, it's like, okay, how much does Deathstroke need a mole on the team to find the identity of like, the green guy, the orange alien, and the robot man, you know, who kind of like walk around in public looking like they do, you know. So, but, you know, that's another thing. We don't need to pick at too much, you know. But to kind of, I guess, move a little bit ahead, they have like the Teen Titans meeting, and it feels like kind of a real meeting, you know. It's like they meet at their, you know, at Titans Tower, and, you know, it's like they've got this, you feel like they've known each other a long time, they've worked, you know, they work together well, there's a sense of team and camaraderie there.
Yeah.
Because I've said that because there's the part where Robin gives up being Robin, and there's that bit where he's like, ceremoniously like removing the signifiers of his Robin suit, you know, and to the point where he's like wearing his like kind of the green baby onesie under his thing. And it's like, this is kind of awkward in front of everybody. It's like, can he just like say, I'm not going to be Robin and, you know, just take the mask off and that be it.
Yeah. So there are two significant things that happen in that issue, aside from the fact that learning about Terra, is Dick Grayson shedding his Robin identity before he has picked a replacement, and talking about how he's not leaving the team, but he's taking a break to find himself, figure himself out, and Kid Flash just straight up leaving.
Yeah.
Feeling like he's never fit in, wanting to go back to college and figure out, you know, am I a superhero? Like, what am I? It's especially interesting given the character arc of Wally West outside of this book in later years after Crisis on Infinite Earths. He takes on the mantle of the Flash for many, many years and embraces the role of a hero and like is not this kind of will he or won't he, you know, get off the pot kind of kid like he is here. And, you know, here he's also kind of, you know, a little bit jealous of all the attention Dick Grayson gets when, you know, Kid Flash says, yeah, I'm leaving. Dick Grayson comes in, oh, I'm giving up being Robin, and everyone is like flocking around him. Oh, what are you going to do? And he's like, yeah, I guess I never really did fit in here.
Yeah.
And I mean, yes, on one level, this is just kind of standard boilerplate superhero plot to, you know, soap opera to turn through. On the other hand, part of what I like about this is it is about, I mean, this isn't the main thing it's about, but parts of this story are about moving on and, you know, kind of finding your identity, which I think, like I said earlier, a lot of the title seems to be about as a whole during Wolfman and Perez's run here. And Dick Grayson, you know, it pays off for him toward the end, how, you know, we can debate how well that comes off. But I like that, you know, I like that there is at least a payoff to it for him. It's not, you know, it's not just, oh yeah, by the way, I'm giving up being Robin. And later on he goes through a speech that, as I just kind of hinted at, I don't think necessarily earns, you know, like his rationale for adopting the title Nightwing feels a little flat. And you're like, okay, whatever. He's just a guy in a suit, and that's fine. It's kind of a weird outfit as well compared to the rest of the group, but whatever.
Well, I mean, it is like you said, since the book started as like a sidekick's book, you know, it's like here's someone who's like my identity is not being a sidekick, you know.
So. Yeah, and I like that it turns that whole concept on its ear.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, one of the things that that they use in this book and kind of the first story and kind of throughout the next one is the detail that Tara has this like contact lens camera, and so we see these like black and white still images of, you know, what she's seeing, and it's like she's taking these pictures and, you know, passing them back to Slade, you know, and it's just kind of a nice recurring device of, you know, that they're actually, you know, under this surveillance, you know, and it's a detail that I think works pretty well. Kind of in the issue 42, we talked about some of the stuff already, but it kind of has Tara hanging out with the Titans in their civilian identities and stuff like that, and you kind of see their kind of the normalcy that they have or attempt to have, you know, and she seems kind of touched by the fact that they include her, and Wonder Girl / Donna like asks her to be, you know, one of her bridesmaids and things like that, you know. So you kind of wonder if she's maybe on the fence about, you know, turning against them, even though she shows no qualms later on. You know?
You're right. That is very nicely handled. There is a little bit of ambivalence there where I think you're supposed to feel exactly that way.
Yeah.
That she's you know, that she is genuinely moved by the acceptance that she feels, at the same time that she can then turn around and just snicker and call them suckers.
Yeah.
So let's talk about betrayal, when Deathstroke attacks Robin and Robin finds out, Dick Grayson, I should say, finds out that his teammates have been captured. It's sort of implied that he's come after Dick Grayson last. I'm like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
He's probably the best trained.
Yeah.
No, there's no probably to it. He worked with Batman. He is the best trained of all of them. Like, you want to take him out first before he can reach anyone else.
Yeah. Well, you like they said, you know, because he's the one with no superpowers, you know, it's like you might want to get, you know, the alien who shoots laser blasts and the Amazon with super strength, you know. So, I mean, I think that it makes... You know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, but I think it can go either way, you know.
But he obviously, like...
But Robin's the one, I guess, if he got away, would cause the most problems, you know, because he would be the most resourceful.
Exactly. Know? And he does get away. And as much as we've seen Deathstroke admonishing Tara not to underestimate the Titans, it's exactly what he does there, which is nice.
Yeah. That's the part where he's like chasing Robin through the park and, you know, wearing his like gold and blue chainmail, whatever armor with his staff and his sword on his back. And he says to some passerby, "What are you looking at?" You know? It's like, dude, you're not inconspicuous, you know. But I like the structure of the episode of this issue very much about like, you know, Dick Grayson going back to, you know, basically where each person got attacked and kind of the booby trap or, you know, whatever they found. And, you know, you see he sees, you know, in kind of either imagination or a flashback for the reader, what happened to them. And it's like the example of like being Batman's sidekick and knowing detective work and deducing what happened, you know?
Yeah. So then the part that really bugs me about this is Adeline and Joseph show up. And this is a plot device I don't care for. The character who suddenly appears and knows everything and unloads all the expository baggage.
Yeah.
You know, and I like Adeline as a character, but that really sticks out to me. And she's like, she seems to know all this stuff, and you're like, well, why didn't you warn them sooner?
Yeah.
And to be fair, okay. You know, she addresses that later. We couldn't get here in time, but that, you know, to me that feels like a cheat.
Yeah. And she says that like she couldn't do it because Tara was there for some reason, you know.
Right.
But there's like this kind of thing where she tells Dick Grayson this and he's like, you know, but Tara couldn't be the traitor. And it's like the newest member who is clearly has emotional control issues and almost killed one of the members, like apparently yesterday. It's like she's not at all suspicious, you know. Two, it's like, why couldn't you think that Adeline is the traitor, just a complete stranger who knows all the secrets herself. You know?
Not to mention the fact that in hindsight, Tara has been very forward about demanding to know their secret identities and everything about them so that she can feel accepted. Like, that didn't set off any, any red flags.
What we see in this, it's like she's not pretending to be a goody-goody that much, you know? I mean, she's kind of got this sort of emotionally immature kind of quality, which I think would make her, it's like, let's let her in on a, you know, on a probationary basis, you know? So, and which is good because it's good that she's not doing this great performance, you know, it makes her character more interesting because her emotions are on the surface, but it's like, she doesn't seem like the most instantly reliable.
Right.
Yeah. You know. But maybe she's proved herself over the issues we haven't read, you know, so.
And then you get the part where issue 44, where Adeline shares her and Slade's backstory and how he became the way he is and who Joseph is. And this is far and away for me the best issue out of this bunch. I really like that story, even though there are some holes in it. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, Joseph is a mutant, a fact that she manages to hide from her super soldier husband, you know, pretty much for 18 years.
Yeah.
Like, really? Mm-hmm. You know, okay, I know he's not the most involved dad as he's, you know, living this secret double life as a mercenary assassin, but like, that's a lot to be keeping right under somebody's
especially
nose.
Especially that when Jericho possesses somebody, his body disappears completely. Yes. So it's not like, you know, he just possessed someone and is still standing there, you know. Well, you and I are going to diverge a little bit about this issue because I think that it's you know, well-written as like kind of a backstory story, you know, and it's, I like the fact that, you know, Adeline talks about how they met during military training and she talks about like learning a peripheral defense, which is like, this has, this seems like a real thing. I don't know, but it's like, it's got me convinced it has a certain verisimilitude and the whole story reads like, an authentic sort of 1970s paramilitary thriller airport novel, you know, like your Alistair MacLean or your Robert Ludlum-y kind of book, you know? So it feels very, you know, authentic to that kind of storytelling, you know? So it works really well, but I don't care about Slade that much, you know, and we've got this character, Tara, who I care about a lot. I'm super interested in. Why do we get an issue about her? Why do we get an issue about Slade? You know, it's like you kind of, you just sort of see him hang out with Wintergreen and you kind of can intuit and tell everything about their relationship and kind of Slade's background. It's like, we're just going to stop the story to a halt to give all of this, like 17 pages of detail, you know, and it's like, it feels like a distraction for stuff that I find more compelling, you know, and kind of more complex too. Like the whole stuff of Tara's, all the issues of Tara's character that don't really come out, that they kind of talk around during the last issue is something that I would enjoy reading a lot more, you know? And it kind of like, it's like, well, no, we care more about Slade than we do about Tara, you know? And that, even though the execution I think is fine, but the decision itself kind of bugs me, you know? And in the next issue, I'm sorry to cut you off, the next issue, it's like, they have another flashback and Wintergreen has this flashback. And it's like, if I didn't care about Slade, I definitely don't care about Wintergreen, you know?
I don't disagree with you that I would have preferred to have seen more Tara backstory. And you're right, that decision, let's give Marv Wolfman and George Perez the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. You know, like, it's not that, you know, they don't care about female characters because obviously, you know, they have, as we mentioned, they have these very strong female characters. Yeah, it's a little weird. And you feel like they're setting up like a Slade Wilson solo title.
Well, yeah.
This very much feels like a backdoor pilot.
Yeah, yeah. And they, there's a lot of stuff with, I mean, they have plans for him. And it kind of helps stuff pay off in the finale story where all the Titans are captured and he sees that his son is one of them and Jericho's captured too. And he's like, it's my son. I don't know what to do. And he's kind of like on a, it's kind of real split second dilemma. And And it kind of like in one level, it kind of gives him a difficult choice and a little kind of like makes his deeds come home to roost because he's been attacking these other young people. But in doing so, one of his own sons has been collateral damage again because, because Jericho lost the use of his vocal cords because of Slade's doing, you know.
And that won't matter as much if you don't care that much for Slade as a character.
I mean, I think Slade's fine as a villain and all that, but I don't really care about him in this storyline because I've got this this other character who's built up who I find much more compelling, you know. And while we're talking about the ending part, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Slade becomes a victim of his own son's mutant powers. And, you know, and so it's almost like his own father-son bond symbolically gets the better of him. You know, it's like I lose control of, you know, my body and my actions, you know, because of my son. You know, it's kind of almost like a symbolic, you know, it's like I've got like, you know, have to make a different decision because my son's involved, you know. So all that I think is fine, you know. There's just this other, this is not that I don't know if I can untie here, you know. Yeah. So.
No, and absolutely, as I said, I would much have preferred to see some more shading, some more background to Tara's character. And I think that would have ultimately affected the story in a positive way that much more because at the end, they sort of have the easy out of, well, she's just crazy.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and toward the, you lose some sympathy for her toward the end when she has her final freak out. And it feels like they're not being entirely true to her character. She just becomes completely unhinged and Slade's moment of indecision about his son to her is a sign that he's betraying her.
Well, also Jericho hits her, in Slade's body, you know.
Yeah,
so
good point. Yeah. But they're just like, whatever, she's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like we don't want anything to get in the way of she's crazy. That's the easy explanation.
Yeah.
That feels a bit unfortunate to me.
Yeah. Well, there's also, because during the kind of the big free-for-all part where Tara's fighting them, it's kind of like they're kind of having the psychoanalysis or trying to do it in the middle of the big fight scene with like the times where like, well, she can't be evil. Well, is she really evil? You know? And it's like, Slade, did you do this? You know, Tara, why are you doing this? You know? So, and it's kind of fun in a way that it's like, rather than, you know, not to contradict myself, but instead of like having her talk it out with an actual psychiatrist or police officer or something like that, in kind of the interrogation room scene, to have it in the middle of this fight scene and this as this big kind of argument, you know. But there's this part where, you know, Raven says, you know, the girl is evil, you know, and the a part later where and she doesn't think like us, which is interesting, you know. But the part where the narration says, due to the fault of no one but herself, she is insane. And it's like, well, come on, you know, you know, it's not her. I mean, they're saying that it's like, it's not Slade Wilson's fault that she's, you know, a villain, but it's her own responsibility. But if she's actually mentally ill, you know, it's like, why can't you just not be mentally ill? You know, so that's kind of, you know, there's interesting stuff going on. And I don't know if a whole backstory Tara issue that had previously come to this would have been great, you know. But I'm kind of curious about, like, you know, was she the kind of person who grew up as a sociopath in, like, this nice background and, like, nothing would change it? Or did she have this horrible background, you know, that, you know, and her mental state is kind of a reflection and a response to that, you know?
It's where she is now, the end result of very bad circumstances that happened to her. It is odd that, you know, we have to explain how Slade Wilson became Deathstroke the Terminator.
Yeah.
But Tara, she's just insane.
Yeah. Like, because like this book is at a pretty high level for this kind of comic, you know, it's like, I don't want to like dismiss certain things, you know?
Right.
So I feel like that they could have done a Tara backstory that was issue that was good, or that the Terminator backstory could have been somewhere else in this and still been good, you know? So I'm not saying any of those things are necessarily poorly executed, you know? It's like, it's just kind of like the greater decision is kind of where my problem is, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's funny that like when Beast Boy attacks her during her freak out. She kind of like messes with her contact lens. So it's almost like her Achilles heel that she's a weapon she's been using them kind of ends up going against her. And she ends up, you know, having this super avalanche that buries everything, which is kind of like a Dark Phoenix freak out kind mm-hmm. of thing, which was one of my, which I hinted in our emails, you know, what a comparison I saw between this
yeah.
and the Dark Phoenix saga, where, you know, a female character, you know, goes evil and, you know, in Dark Phoenix, you know, Jean Grey, you know, has this super high power set, you know, but gets undermined by this bad guy who's doing this brainwashing on her. And as the story reveals it, it's like it unleashes this id personality that taps into all this power and goes crazy. And she kind of gets control of herself at the end and kind of makes a choice to take responsibility and take her own life, you know, which we may not agree with, you know, but it's like she's showing a certain agency there, you know. And it's the Terra stuff on like one level, it may be a little bit more realistic to mental illness because she's got this sociopathic quality, but it kind of like doesn't dig into it quite as much as one would like, you know, as much as I would like, yeah. frankly, you know.
You also have these two very powerful female characters being manipulated by older male characters. Yeah. yeah. So what else do we want to say about this?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've covered my biggest points, you know, so, there's a point we have like the, we didn't talk about the Brother Blood issues cause we skipped over them, but they have, Brother Blood and the, his minions and the Hive are both groups of people wearing these hooded robes, which is like, how many hooded robe bad guys can you have in such yeah. close succession? You know, yeah.
There's an interesting point that Dick Grayson makes, somewhere along the line. I think it's when he's investigating, what happened to everyone, you know, as he's trying to put the pieces together. And I believe it's called back to later where he talks about they just weren't prepared for this sort of thing. And he's right. And it speaks to the very nature of this book versus something like the X-Men. Mm-hmm. You have the Teen Titans, this iteration of the Teen Titans. They get together, they live in this tower on an island in the East River. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, they don't know where it came from. And it was constructed by cyborgs, you know, millionaire scientist father as a way of making it up to him for having had a hand in turning him into this, you know, man machine.
Mm-hmm. We should rent out some of that office space because they can make a killing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. They,
instead of having like six people live there. Yeah.
They don't seem to answer to any governmental authority. There's no oversight. There's no vetting process for new members. It's like, I'm just surprised something like this didn't happen earlier.
Yeah.
It's like, of course, the X-Men had a telepath, you know, who decided who the new members were. But having said all that, like, it's a much more innocent book, I think, up to this point. And yeah, I mean, they've had some storylines that tackle adult issues like drugs and runaways and things like that. But that's pretty after school special stuff compared to, you know, a lot of the text and themes in the X-Men going on at the same time. They're just very different books because they're very different publishers at that point in time too. This is before Crisis on Infinite Earths.
And you know, since it's the same creative team, it's like, this was almost like got Wolfman and Perez Crisis later, you know. Yeah.
But, for all that, you have stuff like the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, Green Lantern, Green Arrow run, you know, that's renowned for its, you know, take on political and economic, you know, social consciousness issues. It seems like a very much more innocent time in comic book publishing.
Yeah.
Even though, like, you have all this other stuff that's been going on in Marvel since the mid-60s, the early to mid-60s, like, tackling all kinds of issues, not to the excess it would get in the 90s.
Well, it's interesting, though, that you make that point. So it's almost like this story is almost like a turning point kind of storyline where just as like Robin's like, I'm not going to be a kid anymore. I'm going to be my own man. The book itself, you know, brings in this issue of like, you know, betrayal, which is kind of a comic book thing anyway, but with certain stakes and kind of the sexual dynamics, which are a little bit more complicated and haven't aged well or are kind of gross as narrative devices, you know, but at the same time, you know, fit with the story in certain ways, you know. So it's almost like the book is moving up to like an older level of, you know, content, you know, just as the characters are.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yes. It's just not as morally complex or shaded mm-hmm. a title or, you know, a universe mm-hmm. as the Marvel universe is. And I think that this, you know, this storyline kind of shows some of the struggle of trying mm-hmm. to grow up, the medium trying to grow up, as we'd see with things like Watchmen and Swamp mm-hmm. Thing and The Dark Knight Returns yeah. and all the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they were necessarily thinking of it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it was just another, you know, another plot line in this ongoing superhero soap opera.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think that they are kind of bringing slightly more grown-up content into these books, you know, at the time, you know, and kind of it would soon get like to like super violent and gross kind of in the 90s, you know, but this is kind of inching up. So it's like, you know, a little more PG than G or PG-13, yeah,
it's very,
you know.
It's yeah. very interesting reading this. Yeah. And knowing what's coming later,
yeah.
you know, just in superhero comics publishing in general.
Yeah. I mean, I made my critiques of, you know, the sexual harassment stuff, you know, yeah. but I feel like I'm a little bit more forgiving of it on, you know, the innocence level nature of it than you might be, you know? So, yeah.
Oh, I'm not against it.
Yeah.
I just think it's worth remarking upon.
Yeah.
It's not a critique mm-hmm. necessarily. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it just really throws it into sharp focus.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's most of what we have to say about that. Mm-hmm. Do we want to just get into the reckoning?
Let's get into the reckoning, yeah, you know, which is when we kind of have our two-person vote as to whether this merits inclusion in the comics canon, and our vote has to be unanimous. We like to pick books, you know, we know... We've kind of lost the explanation of inclusion in the comics canon that well, but we like books that have, you know, creative excellence or lasting influence and measures like that, you know. And I'm a little on the fence on this, and you could maybe be able to persuade me one way or the other. So do you want to go first? And, you know.
Well, I will say, in terms of, say, its cultural impact, mm-hmm. it is far and away the best known story from this run on Teen Titans, mm-hmm. probably the best known Teen Titans story, period, of any iteration of the title. Mm-hmm. There's an animated movie coming out, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, it's been addressed in other media, as yeah. you mentioned.
It's been on TV and the animated movie, and yeah. Deathstroke the Terminator is the villain in the standalone Batman movie that they're working on, apparently. They've cast actor Joe Manganiello as in the role, and I suspect that he might have a cameo in Justice League because they kind of announced that and they had like an on-set tease of him. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if he's going to have like a little appearance in Justice League, and that's kind of why they announced that kind of so early. And so he might turn up in movie theaters later this year, you know.
I will also say that Slade Wilson is the big bad, if you will, in the
That's
second
right.
season of Arrow,
yeah.
which to me is the best season mm-hmm. Of the series to date. It's a different take on the character, mm-hmm. but still an enjoyable one. Mm-hmm. So the character has shown up many times mm-hmm. over the years and currently has a book by DC Comics written by Christopher Priest, a mm-hmm. Well-known
yeah.
writer. And the thing is, I'm kind of torn too. Mm-hmm. I have a great deal of kind of nostalgic affection for it. Mm-hmm. And like I say, it's the best known Teen Titans story. Mm-hmm. It's the only Teen Titans story we've ever considered mm-hmm. for this podcast. There are parts of it that just don't hold up as well. I'm not holding its innocence against mm-hmm. it, but in a way maybe I am because mm-hmm. I want to treat something as, you know, we want to review it in the context of its time mm-hmm. and what it was trying to do at its time. You know, it's unfair to hold it accountable for, mm-hmm. you know, to hold it up to things like The Dark Knight Returns or whatever. But and I don't want to make, I don't want to say it's not great because it's not as good as the X-Men was around this time.
Yeah.
But the X-Men was, I think it's safe to say, you know, just a much deeper and richer reading experience and more, like I said, shaded.
Yeah.
You had Wolverine, you know, who you were delving into issues of, you know, I don't think it's accepted now that Wolverine was mentally ill, but you had a guy who struggled with the urge to kill and, you know, his own bestial nature.
He was an anti-hero with kind of bigger problems than a Raven as an anti-hero would demonstrate, you know, in this book.
Do you mean Tara?
I meant Raven, because Raven, you know, is the daughter of an actual demon,
right?
You know, so she's got this big dark side that she's kind of grappling with, you know.
But Tara as well, you know, like
Tara as well, yeah. But one thing I should throw in though is that, you know, when talking about X-Men and Teen Titans, it's like, and reading this, it's like when we did the Dark Phoenix saga, I was kind of put off by like Chris Claremont's like endless kind of expository word balloons, you know, which felt very overwritten and unnecessary. And this feels a bit cleaner, and because like there's a lot less of that, and the it will convey stuff, you know, through characters saying dialogue, you know, and so not without, you know, unnecessary narration, you know,
a very flowery omniscient narrator.
So I appreciated that, and it's and the groundedness, you know, as a contrast, I thought it's like, you know, I thought worked well for the book, you know, and I feel like X-Men has like more memorable characters, and it would have, you know, like the crazy outlandishness would like feel more, would fire your imagination more and be like cooler and crazier, you know. So I like, you know, X-Men better, but Teen Titans, I remember this, I feel like this reflects it pretty well. And one thing I wanted to toss in, you know, while we're kind of chewing on this and trying to work it out, it's there's a storyline that came out, I think issue 55, that I remember very well and wasn't able to get my hands on for this discussion. And it was kind of like an epilogue to this, where Beast Boy was kind of out for revenge for Slade, you know, blaming him for Tara's death. And they had this big thing where they're tracking him down, and like Slade goes out in the desert to wait for him to attack, and he attacks, but he doesn't attack. Like Beast Boy doesn't attack. He says, you know, I don't want to fight, you know, I don't know what to do, you know. And so they end up like going to a diner and talking out their problems. It's kind of like the analogy to the diner scene between like Pacino and De Niro and Heat, you know. And it was a neat, nice moment in comics where it's like, let's try and solve their problems nonviolently, you know. And if we were including that in this, that might tip the scale for me, but we're not, so, you know, so I don't know what to do, you know, but because I feel like that's a neat issue, and I don't remember, but I haven't read it in like 20 years, you know, so I'll say that I'm inclined to vote against it, you know, but I could be nudge either way, and if I read that issue, I might change my mind with that issue in context, you know.
Yeah, I'm inclined to vote against it as well. I like it, and there are parts of it I like a lot. I just kind of feel like there are some plot holes that on their own aren't that big a deal. They're just minor speed bumps. But then I felt like the final issue, the annual, was a bit of a chore to get through. It didn't feel very emotionally compelling for me. It seemed like, all right, it's time to wrap this up and let's get all the loose ends. Yeah. And you're introducing a new character to Jericho, who... we know very little about, even though we've been given his origin story. It just doesn't feel like it works for me. And there's part of me, because of the nostalgia, you know, sitting here thinking, yeah, maybe we should just go ahead and say yes, you know, but like, I feel like if we're having any qualms at all, then that's an argument that we should not.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm kind of, this is one that like I'm inclined to vote no, but I might, you know, I someone could make an argument that could change my mind on it, you know?
Right. So it's like a B plus.
Yeah.
Maybe. In terms of a letter grade.
Yeah.
Whereas you'd really need an A to get into the comics canon.
Yeah, yeah. So, so sorry, Judas Contract, you know, but what, maybe this one might have a little asterisk on it, you know,
yeah,
you know, based on the that other storyline, you know. So, I have a couple of classic comic ads that I want to read that
all
are
right,
pretty short, you know. One is the Trick Baseball, and it shows someone throwing a baseball that's got kind of a crooked path towards, you know, towards the viewer. It says, "Trick Baseball. It bounces cockeyed, it curves, it dips, it's impossible to catch. It sure to set all the kids on the block spinning after it. 75 cents. And the other one is onion gum. And it has like a thing of a picture piece of gum and someone chewing it with like this look of major distress on his face. And it says...
And little lines coming out of his head.
Yeah, the lines are shooting out all over. Looks like real chewing gum, but tastes like onions. It's too funny. 5 slices to a pack, 40 cents. Yeah. So these are like, boy, it must have been like, I never was like into like, you know, the buying, the prank things as a kid, you know, but so it's kind of like, but being a kid back then in that kind of environment must have been super irritating. You know? It's like, anyone bring something to you? It's like, no, just step away from me with that. Although I did have someone who had like, it was like a wintergreen or double mint box, you know, and you would like, and they would offer you some gum and you would pull the strip of gum out and there would be like this little like mousetrap thing on it that would like snap on your finger. Not as bad as a mousetrap, you know, but it was like I think a better example of a prank than these.
How delightful.
Yeah.
Children are great.
Yeah.
All right. So that brings us to the spinner rack, our final segment where we recommend comics and other media that may or may not have a relationship to the story that we discussed. I'll go first. Yeah. First, I want to recommend Young Avengers volumes 1 and 2, Sidekicks and Family Matters. These are the very first Young Avengers books by Alan Heinberg and Jim Chung. They're a really fun, creative spin on the whole idea of a team of young legacy heroes. Mm. How he creates some of these characters and how they come to carry versions of the names of some of these other characters is, you know, very well thought out and very different from just like, you know, like, my uncle happens to be Barry Allen. And, you know, when I was hanging out with him, the exact same accident that gave him his powers happened to me. Yeah. So now I get to run around and have super speed with him, you know, like, they're not obvious ties, but they're, you know, it's just really well done. I also want to mention The Uncanny X-Men and the New Teen Titans from 1982 by Chris Claremont and Walt Simonson. This is back when intercompany crossovers like this were extremely rare, and that contributed to the sense of it being a real event comic. And it also just has like an all-star cast of creators. You know, Terry Austin is the inker, and like the story's not super great, but it's serviceable. You know, and you know, when you're of a certain age and you see your two teams of favorite characters meeting up, you know, to fight a greater threat, you know, like that's, you know, it hits a sweet spot for, you know, for kids of a certain age or probably for grownups of a certain age. I don't happen to have it handy.
Yeah.
So I haven't read it in several years, but if nothing else, I think it's, an interesting kind of comparison, you know, a way to judge the strengths of the two books against each other.
Yeah, I wonder when the last time, in like present day, you know, there was a big crossover thing. Because I can't remember one from like recent years happening.
Not with like Marvel and DC.
There was like the amalgam things where they had things like Doctor Strange Fate. And it was like characters who are like combined versions of characters, you know. We should maybe think about doing an episode.
Yeah,
like
I really liked some
Superman
of those.
Superman meets Spider-Man or something like that. If we can find them, you know.
Yeah, Steve Rogers, the super soldier.
Yeah.
No, there were a lot of fun stories in there. I do know that DC is currently doing, has announced crossovers with like Looney Tunes titles.
If you love Space Jam, yeah.
But it's a far cry from that period in the 90s when, you know, every week it seemed like there was a DC image or Marvel image crossover, you know, and at least 3 different Batman and Spawn team ups. It felt like, So anyway, yeah, those are my two recommendations.
Yeah, okay. Well, my first recommendation is the Teen Titans TV show, and specifically the fifth season of the show, which has kind of a running arc with Beast Boy kind of doing the sort of coming of age plot. And at the end, he becomes like a leader of the team in his own right, you know, and is kind of, you know, Robin has a a fall and Beast Boy has a success in a way. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, ongoing character development thing. The last episode has a tie in to the Terra storyline, which is kind of haunting and interesting. And the kind of the main story though involves the Brotherhood of Evil, which originated as Doom Patrol villains. And Beast Boy was originally the sidekick of Doom Patrol. And the first two issues have the Doom Patrol in them and kind of recreates the death of the Doom Patrol, which is like, you know, when the Doom Patrol book came out in the 60s and was written out, they were actually killed off. And it kind of cast this weird, you know, no one dies in comic books forever, but, you know, their death has this sort of real sense of finality and fragility to the characters in a way. And the Teen Titans season 5 ends with probably my favorite mass hero versus villain fight in any, like, TV superhero medium. But talking about Doom Patrol makes me want to recommend as comic books, the original Doom Patrol books of the 60s, which are reprinted, I think most recently in Doom Patrol Archives, they were called. But it has like the original team of Robot Man, Negative Man, Elastigirl, the Chief, you know, and their villains like the Animal Vegetable Mineral Man. And so they're like crazy Fantastic Four like fights with like monsters and sci-fi things and stuff like that. And part of the reason why I mentioned that is because Doom Patrol has been revived at various periods, you know, throughout DC history. And
and very much lately by Gerard Way with DC's Young Animal imprint.
Yeah. And Grant Morrison did a very interesting version of it in the late 80s. And that's what we're going to be talking about next time. So we'll be talking about Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, Crawling from the Wreckage, which is the book that has, like, I think the first six issues in his run.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, Grant Morrison, we haven't talked about yet. He's can be divisive to some people, but this is, I think, some of his most fun and accessible stuff, you know, so, and I'm looking forward to it. And it has this sort of tenuous Teen Titans connection, even though none of the Teen Titan characters are in the Crawling from the Wreckage story.
That connection being that Beast Boy was a member of an iteration of the original team.
Yeah. So anyway, meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com.
And we'd like to hear from you. Write in and let us know what you thought of this episode, what you think of the Judas Contract.
If you want to dispute this, so we can, like, maybe if there's some unfinished discussion in here, because it feels a little inconclusive, but we still, you know, stand by our decision to a point.
Yeah. If you want to make an argument for its inclusion into the canon, or just agree with us and shower us with praise, we're open to both of those things. Rate and review the show on iTunes. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. You can post or comment on our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon, and we'll read your correspondence in a future episode. This podcast was produced by Grayson Bergman for The Comics Canon. I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Doom Patrol, Crawling from the Wreckage.